And thanks to Lauren McKenzie of CHLY for that report. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. And interesting problem, this whole housing thing in BC. I know that over in West Van, for example, they're really resisting the push to approve a lot more housing development, and particularly high-density housing development in that community, which in some ways isn't surprising for West Van. But clearly, it is not as easy as we might
have
hoped.
It's not as easy as tic-tac-toe.
It's not.
But, you know, like, look, I'm speaking a personal capacity in the sense that, like, I'm speaking with some degree of industry background expertise, but this represents my personal opinion and not that of my employers or any persons associated with me, or not associated with me for that matter. But here's the deal, right? Like, I think in general, politicians and so forth have a fairly... they're curious about housing, but I think they sometimes lack a nuanced or informed idea of housing. What I mean by that was this idea that permitting and zoning and the approval process is the main thing holding up housing is true in various metros across North America and was true in Vancouver and Toronto until a couple of years ago. It is still true in San Francisco, LA, and so on. But it's actually no longer true basically across all of Canada. And what I mean by that is this. So the great push-up in Canadian housing prices really was concurrent with the era of extraordinarily long, low rates, in secular low rates, starting from around 2010 or earlier, lasting all the way from 2022. And this kind of made housing more affordable just in terms of mortgage payments, but also just made development more predictable, because if rates are going to be 2% forever, you know, you can bet your house on it, and you know, you can do a 5-year development, it's very predictable.
This also had a tendency that created the upward push in housing prices, because of course people tend to buy based on what they can afford
absolutely.
For a monthly payment. So if when rates are low, then your monthly payment's going to be smaller and you can afford a more expensive
house.
And
people just paid more money to fill the gap, essentially. It turns out, you know, there's kind of a golden rule, which is that, you know, anywhere across the developed world, what people can realistically afford for housing over the long run is about a third of their take-home income.
Yeah.
And if you have low rates such that it drops below a third, people will just either consume more housing, buy bigger houses, or drop more money on the existing houses available until it fills up again. So this also drove up land values, as you know. Actually, this phenomenon of land banking emerged in the late 2010s, which actually has gone away.
So just before you move on, what do you mean by land banking?
Well, land banking is sort of a thing. This is a very low-rate era thing where you would buy a piece of land. Well, you buy an operating asset most of the time. It'd be like a low-rise apartment building or a commercial building where the land is underutilized. You have a small building or a low-rise building on a piece of land that's very large or really zoned or designated for high-density uses. And you buy that land with the expectation that eventually one day, you know, you're going to redevelop that land. And land banking really refers to the phenomenon where just investors in general started grabbing a piece of land because there's this fear that other people will grab it. So it's kind of like how hiring in big tech in the middle of COVID, people started hiring people.
You're getting a bit of a rush in land purchases.
It's kind of a FOMO.
Because it is kind of a limited asset.
Yeah, it is a limited asset. And, you know, tech had this obviously as well with star employees. But like it's FOMO, driven by FOMO. Yep. So what happened now, what has happened since 2023 is that rates have gone up secularly. They've come back a little bit again, especially in Canada, but I think everyone realizes that we're out of the low rate secular regime, that we're now in an era of dynamic and cyclical rates. So you can't count on your mortgage being 2% forever for a 30-year amortization. As a result, land values have actually dropped very significantly. I think they've dropped something like 40-50% in Vancouver. Out in the valley, they've dropped probably, realistically speaking, 60-70%. So they've dropped a lot. But one thing, the thing that's holding up construction now is not any of these things. It's not zoning, it's not permitting, it's not any of these things. It's the fact that incomes in Canada are so low relative to its peer economies, primarily the United States, but also Australia and so forth, that people's take-home incomes and the space that's allocated within their incomes for housing can no longer afford mortgage payments. So let's just say, you know, you have $5,000 a month of take-home income. A third of that is, what, you know, $1,700? Just under $1,700? Well, what can you buy today in Vancouver with a $1,700 monthly mortgage payment? Well, nothing, basically.
Yeah.
So people can't qualify for mortgages. People can't do anything. Ultimately, the balance is between incomes and construction cost. And what has caused construction costs to go up so much in the past several years is that actually American inflation and wages have gone up tremendously, right? They've gone up, you know, in some cases like 40%. And Canada's wages and inflation prices have not gone up as much or even at all. So we're now stuck in this really weird situation where for a lot of specialized construction and real estate services, we're on the receiving end of North American prices, because the more specialized and niche the service, the more unified on a continental level the pricing structure.
Right.
Because you have a really specialized crane operator, he's going to be paid in U.S. dollar, even if he works in Canada. Suddenly you're on the price-taking end of high construction costs.
I've heard it discussed a number of times that we're in a position where developers can't build a condo for a price that regular folks can afford.
That's what every single developer will tell you, and every single developer will tell you that the holdup right now is not permitting.
Yeah.
And so this is why I'm kind of surprised and in many ways confused by this person's, this MLA's proposal to just do this thing, because first of all, he's the MLA for Nanaimo and Lensville. I've done some projects in Lensville and Nanaimo. I'm very familiar with the market, and I can say with some confidence that the issue there is absolutely not permitting.
Right.
You know, it's actually construction costs out there because the incomes are not as high as Victoria or Vancouver. So I'm fairly confident about that. Nothing is, you know, certain, knock on wood. But like, first of all, that was just very confusing to me. But secondly, he's in his own bill, he mentions that Vancouver, Victoria, all the big metros with affordability problems have already done this.
Right.
So he's extending this to areas which doesn't need it, don't really have the same kind of issues. It just seems like a one-size-fits-all kind of solution. So but the biggest issue is just simply like, it's just not really the main problem right now. The main problem is construction costs are too high, incomes are too low. And until one of the either construction cost falls, which is, as you know, unlikely, or income goes up, the problem...
Which is also unlikely.
It's more likely than construction costs falling.
Probably.
You know, economies grow, right? But like the I don't know. But the thing is, you know, there's no real like silver bullet here, right? Like people, I know everyone wants this housing silver bullet. You know, the federal government is actually doing a lot in terms of affordable rental housing through their sort of various programs that subsidize not just the construction but ownership of rental housing stock, and they're actually delivering a lot of units, but. You know, I think this kind of thing, I'm less sure about if it will actually be effective.
All right, thanks for that analysis, Stephen.
Slightly weigh in a few things. One is that I think until the Brian Mulroney government, in the 80s, the Canadian government was building social housing, was it not, Stephen?
Well, that's... So people usually point to that, but that's actually has a very minor effect compared to the fact that the tax provision for the ownership of rental buildings, ownership of actually real estate investment had changed sometime in the late 70s, early 80s. I think it was under the Trudeau government. Basically what happened was that at some point the government got a lot of lobbying from Ontario developers and they banned real estate ownership by pension funds. So suddenly the cheapest source of funding was taken away. Now that's been changed, I think, in the 2000s, and that's no longer true. But a lot of the big developers with kind of 20 different pension funds backing it. That's kind of the from the act that actually banned ownership directly, because each would own like less than 5% and was like, it was okay. But so the direct building social housing thing, I think the Canada's actually trying to do it again. Build Canada Homes is the organization that's intended to do it. I'm personally not super confident how effective or useful that is, because usually when the government gets directly into a construction project, there's a whole bunch of like, you know, social issues associated with it. There's kind of
although usually they don't get directly, they're more just at the funding side.
I think the funding side works really well. Like the financing side.
They're not getting into the actual process of building them, but funding them.
Yeah, you know, like also, you know, the government labor costs and stuff like that, construction standards. I think that's a whole ongoing debate. I'm not totally confident that's necessarily the best move.
I'm just going to bring briefly one other thing is that the Little Mountain housing project they had, it was directly east of Queen Elizabeth Park.
Yep.
And then the Gordon Campbell provincial provincial liberal said, oh, we're going to tear it down and we're going to sell it and we're going to have all money for more of this type of social housing. Well, they really didn't build any of that. And that was built in 1954, and it kind of served a purpose for quite a while. And I think that it should have just, I guess there was no way of stopping him. He was dead right to just not have anymore, but that's an example of something that fed a need. And it, and he said, and in his argument that by selling it and the provincial government getting the money, well, you're not going to choose to fund it anyway. If you can maybe weigh in that,
sure. All right. Well, we're gonna head on. Maybe we'll return to these issues another week, because there's a lot of complexity in all these issues around how housing works and how it's funded and what macroeconomic forces encourage and discourage it. Thanks for that input, guys.
A pleasure, as always.
And Non-Sweet is a Vancouver band, and they have an album out of their singles called Non-Sweet Singles. This is one of them. This is called Anthem.
You didn't have a...
hope that cheered you up. That was a little Vancouver Sunshine for you from Vancouver band Non-Sweet. The track was Anthem from their album Non-Sweet Singles. We're going to be back in a couple of minutes with Peter's piece. What are you going to be talking about?
The oil tanker re-ascending. No, it hasn't happened yet, but you know they're talking about having oil tankers on.
Lifting the oil tanker ban on the northern coast, yeah. Okay. All right, well, we'll be back to talk to Peter about that in a couple moments. Well, a couple minutes. But first this.
My name's Katie. You want some cool new music to listen to? Want to know about up-and-coming artists, albums, and more? Well, come hang out with me every Tuesday from 12 to 1. Raccoon City's where I'll be. Hope to see you there.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. At lots of schools, chicken nuggets, burgers, and pizza are what's for lunch. And Yandel Ramirez, a high school senior in the Bronx, says it's high time to rethink that menu.
This is not healthy. We need to show students that there is an alternative choice that they could have.
Eating more fresh fruits and vegetables is good for kids' health and for the climate. Research shows that producing meat and dairy creates a lot of heat-trapping carbon pollution. So as part of a group called the Plant-Powered Youth Steering Committee, he's pushing for more plant-based foods in schools. This past summer, he and other teens from across the U.S. went to Washington, D.C. and met with elected officials and members of the USDA.
We talked about establishing a minimum fiber requirement in school meals, ensure plant-based meal options like beans, peas, and lentils are offered on a daily basis.
He says providing these choices at school is especially important for kids who might otherwise rarely eat them.
If you offer these options to kids when they're younger, they will probably have a greater chance of actually, you know, pursuing a healthier route.
For their bodies and for the climate. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We're just heading into the last part of the show. My name is Magus Stevens, and with me is Peter R.H. And he's going to be talking about the potential lifting of the tanker ban on the North Coast. Before we get into that, though, just remind you that Democracy Now! Is coming up in just under 10 minutes right here at 11 o'clock. So stay tuned for that. Peter.
Okay, so you're right, the potential lifting it, because it's still on the books, which was 2019. 2019 Oil Tanker Moratorium Act, Bill C-48, prohibits tankers carrying more than 12,500 metric tons of crude oil or persistent oil from loading or unloading the northern British Columbia waters, including with the Dixon entrance.
Hecate Strait.
Oh, you got that one. And Queen Charlotte Sound. So that's specific what it was. There was an oil tanker moratorium act in 1971. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of, they wanted to make it more formal in 2019.
Yeah.
And the fact that they wanted to make it more formal in 2019, then all of a sudden there becomes a reason to possibly repeal it seems to be suspect. Now, my knee-jerk reaction was to be against the repealing of it.
That was my knee-jerk reaction, too.
But I sort of wanted to go past that. So yeah. I looked at a few other things. I tried to see the other side. Now, one person on YouTube was talking about Elizabeth May of the Green Party. She has a seat in Parliament. And she did a posting about why these are... she contends it's the fourth treacherous waters in the world, first treacherous in Canada. Now, his thing about it, just some person who did something on YouTube, was that there are passenger ships constantly in that area. Well, I don't think having a big giant tanker is quite the equivalent. I mean, you have more of a potential of risk, I would think, Magnus. Am I thinking straight on that one? Like, his argument was that, well, you already have all this traffic anyway there, including passengers. He says, well, nobody sank the passenger ship yet.
Yeah, I mean, I can't comment on the specifics of that because I will say this, that, you know, just because things are similar doesn't mean they're the same. And, you know, the situation for, you know, cruise ships, I presume that's what he's talking about, that navigate up through that way on their way to Alaska.
And ferries.
Yeah, and ferries. Although I think there's sort of an inside passage you can take much of the way. You know, so you're protected by islands that are off the coast. And you're right. Not actually out in the open sea. Obviously, that's not going to be the same for tankers, which would be arriving at, I presume it's Prince Rupert on the coast there, where there'd be some sort of terminal and then heading out through those wild waters.
So I'm just going to go by the fact that they did in 2019, they felt strongly, well, we'll make it more official. Now, that's not a scientific thing. It's more saying, well, that was doing at that time. Now, the Vancouver Sun had a article. It was on, I think it was Saturday. And their headline was, Explainer, Canada's moratorium on North Coast oil tankers was aimed at Alaska, which was, that was 1971. But it's funny that in 2019 they did it. So this is what you call a spin, because they, you know, when you read the article, it's sort of, oh, I guess it's sitting on the fence, but it's still giving you reasons why we should keep it in place. The other thing is that I think the whole idea we don't want all tankers there is sort of basic environmentalism, because you just need one oil spill to cause a lot of trouble with it. And I think that,
well, one only has to think back to the huge disaster of the Exxon Valdez tanker spill, which was up in Alaska probably 30 years ago or more. But that was, you know, released a huge oil slick into those really sensitive waters in Alaska, and was quite a devastating, took a long time to do recovery.
Even in British Columbia, public opinion is sort of favorable towards it.
The ban?
To not having it.
Oh, okay.
I mean, to sort of having the pipelines, like 54%.
Right.
So, one thing I think over the years, well, okay, this is sort of an edgy thing, but people have been sort of, in some factors, questioning the climate change, or the whole narrative about it, or the climate change concern. And things like this sort of make people say, well, Your Mark Carney says, I'm still concerned about climate change, and he does something like this, which goes counter to a basic environmentalism, you know, a basicness. And he even is sort of rescinding a bit with that deal with Alberta, that the climate change concerns there. So, I mean, this is
giving Alberta sort of a carve-out on certain environmental regulations, particularly around using fossil fuels for energy or electrical production. They were given a bit of a break on that.
So this is why people have sort of said, well, we're sort of suspect. I mean, we don't know what your angle really is on this. And so, you know, there still is. Denise Rancourt, even though he's a bit, I don't know, I heard him in 2008.
Who is he?
He taught physics at the University of Ottawa.
Right.
And there was a certain reasons why. I mean, a variety of things happened to him. But I heard him challenge in 2008 when he was at UBC the concepts of the climate change theory. He was saying that it was used to cover up other environmental issues and so on. Patrick Moore. Patrick Moore used to be with Greenpeace. He's been counter to it. Now, I tried to go to his website and find out what he thought about oil tanker bans. He actually seems to be for pipelines, actually. But it's not clear on this issue where he stands. His office downtown, you can't get into because it's like, even, they don't, you know, like, did you notice, I don't know, you don't go to downtown offices much, Magnus. But they have
to downtown offices? No, well, not that often.
Well, you know, you just can't stroll into them anymore. Like, it's his one is directly opposite Simon Fraser Harbor Center. You know, it's an older kind of building, and they just did it now. It's sort of blocked off. In fact, you can't even dial the number to go in. So I just thought about asking, because it's not clear. I don't know where his position is on it or not. But he's probably for, I would think he's probably for this. Well, the thing is about the lifting of the moratorium, it hasn't happened yet.
So we got about 30 seconds for you to wrap up.
Well, he's, but they're opening, it's like the frog in the boiling water.
Mm-hmm.
And the frog's going to have some oil, petroleum added to it because of Mark Carney. Because yeah. It's like you do one thing, they say, oh, we haven't repealed the law yet. And yet it's like you're putting the whole domino theory, to misquote Eisenhower.
So to sum up, Your initial reaction was against it, and it sounds like you're still against it, having looked into it.
I'm still against it, but anyway.
All right, that's the time we have. Thanks for listening today. Democracy Now! Is up at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for lots more great programming here on CJSF.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious. Something mundane, something every day, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday. From 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.